You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm really happy to be here today with Isabel Allende, the author most recently of The Stories of Eva Luna, which is in certain ways a continuation of the themes and concerns in her previous novel, Eva Luna, author too of The House of the Spirits and of Love and Shadows. I can't really think of another book like this, a book written ostensibly by the character created in the previous novel. What led to it?
Pure necessity. I had recently met a gringo lawyer, moved to this country. I didn't have a room of my own. No time, space, peace of mind for a novel. And I can't stop writing. It's an organic necessity. So I thought, well, maybe this is the time to try this very hard genre of short novels. Hard, especially for people of Spanish descent, as I am, because we don't have a very long tradition in short stories. We tend to write novels, overdone, heavy Baroque novels. And short stories is such a different genre. I mean, it's more important what you leave out than what you really write. And so I decided that it was a good time for that, because the only advantage of short stories is that you need less continuous periods of time. You can write a short story, let's say, in 2 weeks, in a month, and then stop, and then start again. You cannot do that in a novel.
In fact, our great short story writer, Raymond Carver, said that it was he never wrote a novel, and that it was because, he said, there were always the children, and then there was the alcoholism, and then there was the divorce, and nothing allowed him to sit still for long enough.
Yeah.
To do a novel. I think that's true, but then there are people like Borges who never wanted to.
I feel more comfortable with a novel. I worked a lot with these short stories because I don't know how to write short stories. I write a novel and then I cut it until it has five pages long. but that's not the way it should be done. I'm sure there's an easier way of doing it.
Well, do you mean to say that there are 23 cut down novels in the stories.
Aborted novels.
Aborted novels in the stories of Eva Luna?
More or less. If you, many people have pointed out that in these stories, you have the whole lives of all the characters in the short story, and that's not how short stories are. In a short story, it's usually one event or one emotion or one moment, one impulse, something very, very brief.
The stories are preceded with an epigraph from the Arabian Nights, which brings a whole area, nowadays at least, of sexual narrative strategy. It's frequently said that, you know, Scheherazade talking to Shahryar at night is placating the male ego, putting to sleep the attempts to rape and kill all of the virgins of Arabia. And here, too, the opening story in The Stories of Eva Luna by Isabel Allende is a story of a woman, essentially a writer, a proto-writer, who is calming the beast of a dictator. I just wondered, are stories a feminine art, and can they heal political frenzy?
Well, I never thought of it that way. I thought it the other way around. I thought that storytelling was a seducing strategy. I got a husband with a story. And not only him, other men too. So
no, really, tell me how.
Well, very easy. You just tell them a story. And it's a very seductive strategy. Try it. Everybody loves a story. If you just do this experiment, get in an elevator, and halfway through say, once upon a time, and you'll see that no one leaves the elevator. Everybody stays there. They want to listen what's going on, what will happen. So I don't think it's calming the beast. But storytelling is also I think, in my case at least, it's like an attempt to understand, to go behind or beyond the plot and try to find the meaning of the story. What is there hiding behind it? That's why what I do when I write, and I think that that is what people, why people are so fascinated with stories. And this has been with human nature for millenniums, this love of storytelling, because we all want to know what will happen, because maybe we will find some particle of truth. We will identify with something. We will get the meaning of something in the story. That's why memorable stories never die, and they become myths and legends.
What were the stories that you grew up with as a child?
I grew up in the kitchen of my grandfather's house, where the radio was always on. In Latin America, we have this culture of soap operas on the radio. Now they are on TV, but at that time it was the radio. So you heard these voices, which were always very seductive voices, telling you the lives of these incredible characters. I grew up listening to those stories, listening to the gossip of the servants in the house and the wonderful, incredible magic stories of my grandmother.
Mm. What I was wondering was, you know, American children might grow up with Paul Bunyan, but still they hear Cinderella, and Russian children hear the stories of Baba Yaga. I was wondering, which are the fairy stories that you would have been told?
When I was a child, my parents divorced when I was very young, and my father disappeared from my life completely. I never saw him. I only saw him once many, many years later in the morgue, because he died in the street and I had to identify his body. Nothing was left of my father, not even a photograph, no memories of him. But there was a basement in my grandfather's house that was a forbidden territory. We were not supposed to go there. But of course I found a way of getting in. And there I found a trunk. And the trunk had the initials of my father's name. So it was a most, most forbidden thing.
Well, this is a wonderful story already. We must open this trunk.
We must open the trunk, the Pandora's box. And I opened it, of course, and it was full of books, of children's books. And that was the legacy, the only legacy that I have of my father. They were very old books, yellow, brittle papers. And they were Emilio Salgari, Julio Verne, all those great writers, the classic writers in Spanish. And I never realized
what to us is Julio Verne, of course. Thank
yes.
you.
All those great writers. And also some fairy tales from faraway places like Finland, Lithuania, Greek mythology, Roman mythology. Those wonderful books adapted for children, and I read them in the basement with a candle, with all the secrecy and all that clandestine feeling.
I want to tell a story. It's sort of amusing. I come from a non-storytelling family, although they liked language. And the first time I'd ever heard a myth was in school. You know, the teacher told the story of Pandora's box, but I'd never heard the word myth. And so I came home from school and I told my parents, "Oh, I'm so interested in Greek and Roman myths." And my parents, you know, were not, you know, they were first generation Americans, and they didn't know what myths were particularly either. So I remember my father took me to the library. They were very encouraging. We said to the librarian, "We're looking for books of Greek and Roman mints." And they said, "You mean like rare coins?" I said, "No, no. My gods and goddesses and myths, you know."
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Those things come into a child's life, whether they're found in a basement, in a trunk or not, as from another universe. You know,
I think that literature should be forbidden. If it was forbidden, everybody would read.
Yes, thank you.
I was brought up in a house which was full of books, but the only books that interested me were the forbidden ones. So I was reading Marquis de Sade when I was 10, taking the book to school, to a nun's school. I read Arabian Nights when I was 12 because it was hidden in my stepfather's closet, locked closet. It was erotic. I was not supposed to read it. So I have the most wonderful memories of the forbidden literature. And that trunk, which contained this very innocent literature, because it had belonged to my father, was also forbidden. So I remember the basement as the womb of the house, a sealed, secret, dark place where I was like in my mother's womb. And there was this wonderful treasure of literature.
I'm talking to Isabel Allende, the author of The Stories of Eva Luna, recently published by Athenaeum. The stories made me think of something also very precious to me. There are many grandmothers and crone figures in the book. I'm thinking in particular of the saint Clarissa.
She was my Aunt Teresa.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I have no imagination whatsoever, Michael. I just remember, and I watch, I listen. These stories are all based on real people, on real events. I can explain every story in the book. You won't believe that, but I can. And that Clarissa, that wonderful angel in that book, was my Aunt Teresa.
I was wondering what you thought of the sudden influx or return of angels into literature. I think, you know, just as Dostoevsky said that everyone had come out from under Gogol's overcoat, I think there's been a whole battalion of angels that came to light after The Very Old Man with Enormous Wings.
What a wonderful story.
A very great story.
I think that's one of the greatest stories of García Márquez.
Well, I think it's astonishing because all over the world, subsequent to that story, angels about whom writers had previously been, at best, embarrassed, came flocking back on enormous wings.
Yes.
You know? Hundreds, really hundreds of angel stories. So I wondered, this particular angel, your angel, has on her back, what is the word, scars where the wings...
She has two little lumps, and the doctor says it's cancer.
But we know that it's the wings that are about to sprout.
Yeah.
But when you are writing, say, the story that will involve an angel, is it a salute to García Márquez? Are you nervous? Oh, no, must be careful here. They're leaning over my shoulder and saying too much magical realism. What is your feeling about that progenitor?
Oh, when my books have been, I mean, I've been criticized, if you can call it that, because some critics say, especially with my first book, that there's a great influence of García Márquez. I feel very flattered. I just love it. Because if I was a dancer and somebody said that I dance like Nureyev, I would be very flattered. He's the greatest Latin American writer of all times. And if in any way I'm compared to him, I feel very, very well. But I have to admit that when I write, I don't have 100 years of solitude on my table and I copy paragraph by paragraph. I don't do that. On the other hand... But on the other hand, when I write, I totally forget. I sit down and open a vein. I don't know what I'm writing. The first draft just comes out in a very organic way. And then when it's finished, I read it. It's usually a mess. And only then I know what the story is about. And then I can start working on language structure and trying to cut away everything that doesn't work for the story or is not necessary in the story. But the first draft is just very natural. It's just like talking to someone that is very close and very dear in a very intimate tone. So I'm not aware of influences, and I'm not afraid of the influences either. So if there are angels and demons in other people's stories, I don't mind.
It's interesting to me because when Mark Helpern's book, A Winter's Tale, came out, this is a book set in New York. It contains flying horses and pogo stick jumping gangsters. And I thought to myself, you know, shame, shame, Mr. Helpern. I really do think that the South American magic realism is, as Garcia Marquez says, indigenous to the country, that it was an act of imaginative imperialism for Helpern to be writing in this manner, that I understand it when Isaac Bashevis Singer does. He's speaking of, you know, Poland and the demons of that life. But the great thing, I would say, the terror of America is that we've thrown out the demons. You know, we live a life largely without gods, without goddesses, without demons, and largely without poetry. And I thought that it was typical American imperialism for Helpern to be raiding the South American treasure chest and writing a North American, South American novel.
I don't agree with you at all.
Okay.
At all. I think that only for a few decades in Europe, in Western Europe, and in the United States, people have had the illusion that they can control everything. And they have denied or ignored everything that they cannot control, they cannot buy, they cannot possess. And this has been reflected in literature. And the things that we do control and we do possess are very few. So literature became very minimalist, and because they ignored all those invisible forces that had been accepted before in these same places, in literature and in life, and that are always accepted in what you call the third world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what that is the dimension of what you call magic realism, as if it was a literary device. But it's just the acceptance of everything that is there, and it's also in New York. It's everywhere.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And yet I feel, though, that Americans have yet to discover the American form of legend, that it doesn't simply do to turn to the great Latin American writers and appropriate.
But they are discovering it, and they are using it, and they did before, too. I mean, all Latin American writers have been influenced by Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have this generation of women writers in this country that have their style that accepts these invisible forces, passions, emotions, legends, traditions, myths, the overwhelming power of nature, the demons and the angels that we all have. And they are creating wonderful literature that is not in the same style of Latin American literature or African poetry or Asian sagas or Scandinavian Gothic literature. No, it's American, very American, but it has a space for all those invisible forces.
I'm speaking to Isabel Allende, whose most recent book, The Stories of Eva Luna, has recently been published by Athenaeum. I wanted to get back to the subject of this interesting and particular group of stories. Does Eva Luna write a story that is different from a story that Isabel Allende might write?
Yes. Although Eva Luna speaks for me in the novel, she says all the things that I always wanted to say and nobody listened. In this book, it's her tone, her voice, narrating. And that limits me, in a way, because Eva Luna is an orphan child, a very marginal person, a survivor, who lives in a very poor environment and had absolutely no formal education. She has the gift of storytelling and the instinct to grab reality and transform it into fiction. But she's not an educated person. She doesn't know practically nothing about the world. So all the stories are placed in an environment and in a time that she would know. All the stories that I could create that were not related to that geographical space or to that time that she would be aware of, I had to eliminate from the collection. So it's not really me. But of course, I pick up the characters, I choose the stories. I'm like God. I can do anything.
Were you tempted, Arabian Nights style, to maintain a frame story of Eva Luna and her lover that would wind through and connect the collection?
No, because I think the stories are connected with secret, invisible threads.
I agree with you. Yes.
I wanted the reader... Well, when I read a collection of short stories, I have the feeling that I have read fragments. And I don't... Somehow it is as if it's not a whole meal. It's like hors d'oeuvres only. And I wanted the reader to, when they finish the book, to feel that it was a book, a whole book. So the stories are connected first by the tone and the voice of the narrator. Although some of the stories are in first person or in second and third person, it's always her talking. Then I wanted, and that tone is a very whispered tone. It's something that is murmured in your ear in a very quiet voice. Then they are all love stories, but I couldn't say this because I'm a woman writer and I would be accused of being sentimental, so I couldn't say that. But they are love mm-hmm. stories. And then they are all united by this geographic space, this universe that the book has, that belongs to the book only. So I didn't need to have, like in Arabian Nights, the other story justifying the stories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you surprised? Recently the book has appeared and is gradually mounting its way on the New York Times bestseller list. This is fairly unusual for a collection of stories. Were you surprised, and how do you take your popularity?
I'm always surprised that people would buy anything that I read, because I should be paying people to read it. I love to write. And the fact that I make a living with this is, to me, amazing, mm-hmm. absolutely amazing. When I wrote my first book, The House of the Spirits, no one wanted to read it. And I had to mail it to Spain to an agent I didn't know. And fortunately, the book was protected by some benevolent angels again, and it got published and it was very successful, but it always surprises me. I have this fear. I sometimes have these nightmares that I will be caught and people will find out that all this is a bluff, that and everything will end in 24 hours, because it started in 24 hours, so sudden that it might end so suddenly too.
That's interesting. Do you still concurrently do journalism? You started as a journalist, I believe.
I started as a journalist, but I don't do journalism anymore. It's very time consuming. And then I was a lousy journalist. I really was. You know, I was always putting myself in the middle of the story. I could never be objective. I invented all the time. I lied all the time. And if there were no news, I just made them up. I was never caught.
A lot of writers talk about their years in journalism as being years when they learned to strangle the truth. I remember Donald Barthelme telling me that although he never distinctly lied, he would include only the most aberrant and inappropriate details.
No, I would have made it up. I wouldn't care. But I'm sure that in a twisted way, and that's what I do in literature, actually, by lying, you achieve a particle of truth. Let me give you an example. If, let's say that I had to write an interview with a chorus girl, and she didn't want her name to appear, that would give me a wonderful freedom to make up the whole character. So I would interview 15 chorus girls, and then I would create the stereotype that I thought was adequate, and put in her lips all the words that I wanted to say. And I do the same thing in literature now. I wasn't caught there then, and I haven't been caught yet.
What are you working on now? What synthesis of 15 chorus girls is?
I start a new book always in January 8th, that doesn't mean that every January 8th I start a new book, but when I finish a book, I wait until the next year to begin a book. So last year, January 8th, I began a novel. I had to stop in August because I've been promoting this book and too many things have happened in my life. But April 1st, I hope to be back writing. I think it will be a long novel.
Do you think, you'd say that you can seduce with a story? Is that the secret of maintaining a marriage, a novel?
Yeah, that's one of the secrets. That's one of the secrets. But he has seduced me with... My mother says that I married the story. I didn't marry the man. He's a guy that is loaded with stories. He's a lawyer, and he has all his clients' stories, and his own life is like a novel. So it's a fascinating character. We call him at home the benefactor, like one of the characters in that book.
Have his stories begun to be told by you?
2/3 of the stories in that collection belong to him.
Really?
Yes. I just transplanted them to a place I know better. When I moved to this country, my publishers were very afraid. They said, what are you going to write about now? No more three-leg tables, no more banana republics and awful dictators, no more exotic characters. What are you going to write about? Well, I moved to California. I will never run out of stories. I've lived 3 years in this place and I have not met one normal human being. They are all weird. The stuff novels are made of, they are... I mean, in the place where I live, they're all into organic chicken, channeling, bondage, hot tubs, shrinks, saving whales. I mean, the air is loaded with stories. There are more tarot readers and palm readers in California than the whole of Latin America.
And long may they wave. I've been talking to Isabel Allende. Her most recent book is The Stories of Eva Luna. It's published by Athenaeum. And it's delightful that you've been able to come here and talk to us.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse clock time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.